newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people.
Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis of what's going on in the news media this week, with some veteran journalists giving you insight into newsroom decision-making and some of the ethical challenges that confront American journalism. That's our hope, anyway. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now publishing the Upstate American on Substack. And I'm joined here by two of my fellow former editors, Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady, and Barbara Lombardo, who is executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. How are we today?
Happy July.
We are like a bad penny. We keep showing up.
Oh, don't say that. First of all, pennies.
First of all,
pennies are becoming extinct.
Yes, that's right.
We are still going strong.
Damn it, bad metaphor.
Cut that right out.
Yeah, what can we do here? Anyway, on we go. So we're going to have some interesting insight into some of the changes going on in journalism. I'd like to actually start this week with, because we were all editors during the digital transition, right? I started in a newsroom with a manual typewriter and a paste pot on my desk, right?
Yes, you did.
That was before my time, Rex.
Okay.
We're not that endangered.
So we have been through this radical change so that we all became digital-first news organizations. And now what is happening, of course, is that newsrooms are making a push into short-form video. And I'm struck by this comment from Joe Kahn, who is the executive editor of the New York Times. He said in an interview with Business Insider last week that the New York Times' push into short-form video is, quote, as big a transformation as the print-to-digital transformation was. So he's saying that by moving the New York Times onto TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube, he says we're in a race against time to make sure that good quality journalism competes with AI-generated slop and influencer-generated non-original journalism. How about that? And so the Times is going to add scores of video journalists. Good news for video journalists out there. Go work for the New York Times. And that the video-first effort will touch every part of the newsroom. Isn't that a remarkable thing that it's going to be as big as this transformation we've been through already?
Easy for him to say and do with all his money down there in New York City and all his scores of journalists and all his money. We have been through this before, Rex, haven't we? Our poor newsroom struggled to learn video editing and learn how to be on camera. And it was a huge amount of time with not much result. I will agree. I love the New York Times videos, but it takes a certain amount of professionalism and training and investment. And I'm not sure local news organizations that are struggling, how successful they are going to be. There's nothing I like really more than listening to David Sanger talk about his story he wrote about international news for the New York Times. It's really, I love to see his face. I love to see how good he is at talking. But I can tell you that the distance between wanting to do it and doing it well enough that people will actually pay attention to it is a far distance.
Definitely is a challenge to do it, especially on a small scale media level. But it's not so amazing. It just makes common business sense, and it's probably overdue. It brings me back to one of my many publishers over the years was a woman named Margot Drobny, and one of the many wise things that she had said, this is before the internet was a thing, and we were making this radical change in the early 1980s of moving the afternoon publication of the paper to morning publication, which was, oh my God, what are we doing? And she said, when people are buying hamburgers, you need to be there where they're out there looking for the hamburgers, I think was her. Maybe she should have said breakfast sandwiches. When people are, you need to be selling it where people are buying and when yes. people are buying. And she could use data to see that morning is when people were looking for their newspapers. So we made this radical switch of morning publication, which some people thought was good. Some people were worried about it. This is just the same thing on a different scale. You need to be there where people are going to be finding you and looking for you.
The old expression was, you have to send the miners to the coal face, which was, sorry if
you never heard that in Saratoga.
It's probably from the Dakotas.
I thought it was a great
old expression. Cement plant again.
Yeah, the cement plant. Here we are once again. Yeah.
Doesn't it just make sense to do what they're doing?
But I remember having this conversation in this studio maybe 10 years ago when we said we have to be where the readers are, and being denigrated for saying you're talking about lowering standards. And I have to think that, frankly, if TikTok is being done by a great newsroom on the standards of the New York Times, I bet they're going to do TikTok that is valid journalism, right? And so maybe that's a standard that we all have to live up to.
Do you remember when we were first became a thing on the internet, and then we were trying to get videos? And even at a tiny paper like the Saratogian, we would have expectations of the reporters who were really hired because they could interview and write. They were also expected, and they accomplished this, to get at least 30 seconds or whatever, get some time asking one of their questions on their phone, and then having to come back and being able to turn that into, they needed to have the skills to also edit it. And some of them were rough around the edges. Some people were naturals and could make longer videos. But we expected them to have something that you would link to. We understood vaguely that people wanted to see videos and you would link to it. So that was just the start of it. But it was very difficult to get something worthwhile.
Yeah, I'm optimistic that if the New York Times invests a lot of money and a lot of manpower into this, that they will take the short form video to new places and show and be a model for the news industry to follow in ways of producing news in a way that the public will grasp, that the public will follow, and the public will trust.
Well, that is essential, and it is an ethical requirement. I have something here that I'm going to read from Tom Rosensteel, who's the co-author of the wonderful book, The Elements of Journalism, with Bill Kovach. Kovach and Rosensteel have this book published for now probably 20 years ago, which is a professional standard for journalism, and makes the point that journalism, to be ethical and to succeed, must strive to keep the significant, interesting, and relevant. That is, it's not enough to just do great reporting and to put it out there. You need to put it in a form that people will take it in. As he writes here, part of the journalist's responsibility is providing information in such a way that people will be inclined to listen. Journalists must thus strive to make the significant, interesting, and relevant. So I guess that's what this is about. They're making it interesting.
Yeah, and to actually produce something that is interesting to look at and to listen to, is going to be a time-consuming effort. And not every story is going to lend itself to a visual element. Sometimes it might be just the person telling the story looking at you. I don't know. And then they have to have B-roll of what they're talking about behind them. So it's a multifaceted way of reporting.
And you have to respect the time of the person who's consuming the video, too, because there's nothing that I hate more than wasting time listening to a preamble when I could just get the basic news I need if I read it. So the best videos get to the point and do it in a fascinating way.
Yeah, and sometimes the storyteller can make all the difference. Like the Boston Globe has this, did we talk about her last week? This reporter named Emily Steele. She is the Boston Globe's first social media reporter, supposedly, and Boston. And when she goes to report a story, therefore, she is perceived by the people she's interviewing as authentic. And when she delivers it on screen, she is the voice of Boston. And sometimes something as little as that can make a difference, right, in actually getting across credibility.
This story is read to you by an AI voice from Boston, named Chelsea.
I suppose it could be. But it's interesting because we are in this transitional phase. There's the new Reuters Digital News Report has been saying this to local TV news. The audience is still available for local TV news in the way the audience is still available for local newspapers that we used to edit, but people want the news to come to them. So nowadays, people are saying, last year was the first year that for the first time, more people worldwide got their news through social and video platforms than through the news organization's own websites or apps. So people aren't coming to us for the news. We need to deliver it to them in whatever platforms they might be using.
Sure, because in the old days, if you wanted to know what the news was from the TV, which lots of people did, you had to go to who was telling the news, and you had to go at 6 o'clock at night. Right. That's no longer the case, so why should we be surprised that people are no longer coming to us? They don't need to.
And then this is scary because what we're doing is we're relying on the algorithms of the browsers and the search engines and the AI. And so we need, in our industry, we need to be able to not outsmart them, but at least keep pace with what they're doing so our content gets served up in a way that is efficient and it gets not clicked on. We don't want to get clicked on anywhere. The idea that people are going to come to our website, I think, is out the door. It's just like the idea that they're going to buy our paper, go down to the newsstand and buy the paper. We've got to take those different, all those little pieces and send them out into a world and hope they find a good home.
It actually makes it harder than it used to be, and it requires new skills in the newsroom and requires journalists to become a bit more attuned to the marketing, to the delivery of their pieces. I used to want to insulate the newsroom from marketing, right? And to say, you guys don't have to worry about it, just do the reporting. But I think that's no longer enough, that journalists have to be actively engaged in selling their product.
What do you mean by that? That kind of disturbs me when you say selling. You need to be able to promote yourself. But
the newspaper, the media organization has a brand that they can promote. But then we've also encouraged the reporters, the photographers, the editors to have their own brand. And so they're out there. Is that where you're going?
I think there needs to be, nowadays, among the skills that a journalist needs to have is the ability to project the content out into the marketplace, not just the ability to create it. Or at least if you're not going to have that skill yourself, you better have somebody working right alongside you, a producer perhaps, working with you if you're only a news gatherer. And that was always the case for, say, network news correspondents. We print journalists were proud that we could just go out and be a little one-man bands, pardon me for being gender-specific there.
One-person bands.
Oh, please, yes.
We just had to file the story, shut off the computer, and walk out the door, and the press people would take care of the rest.
Yeah. However, that seems not to be the case now. We were just watching this before the microphones turned on, this wonderful video produced, Barbara, by your son, David Lombardo.
Tell me more.
David, of course, hosts the Capitol Press Room, produced by Public Media of Central New York, and is at the Capitol. And he did this fun video showing him in the Capitol, which is just by way of promotion, actually.
Because he works out of the Capitol and covers what's happening there.
And you want someone who has, nowadays we're looking for a bit more personality, I think, in journalists than we used to expect. Hopefully, personality that is, that will translate into voice. We're welcoming a little more voice and engagement on the part of the journalists.
Yeah, I'll be humming the Pointer Sisters all day now. And I think it's reflective of the fact that the notion he was trying to convey is the fact that it's a slow time at the Capitol. He's got the place to himself, and he starts mimicking the Hugh Grant moves from the movie Love Actually, I think. Hmm. But at the end, it shows what a serious reporter he is as well. A wonderful video. People should try
it. It was, thank you both for pointing it out to me this morning. And what I liked about it was that it was fun. So it's, he, when he's covering things, it's serious, although he has a lighthearted touch to his dispatches section. But it was fun, and people could use a little bit of fun.
We can use a little bit of fun. Folks, we would be interested in your thoughts always. What do you think? What are you looking for in your news coverage? And are you going to be looking for news coverage on platforms other than those where you're now getting it? Media@wamc.org is how you can interact with us. We always love to hear from you. And we heard from Tony, a listener who was commenting on our commentary last week about the error made by NPR's Nina Totenberg. Nina was the longtime Supreme Court reporter, is the longtime Supreme Court reporter for NPR News, and she is the one who made the mistake by releasing incorrect information about the retirement of Supreme Court Justice. And Tony's point is this: I deeply respect Ms. Totenberg and her well-respected career in covering the Supreme Court, he writes. I am angry that this error was made at all, and moreover, the tepid way that NPR handled it. My initial sense is that something harsher should have been implemented. It taints NPR's reputation and, by extension, all journalists. I'm most interested in your response. So what penalty, beyond being embarrassed, should have been imposed on a reporter who makes this kind of mistake?
Part of the problem is news organizations used to have public editors who would dive into this kind of an issue and then write a report that explains what happened. There's also a complication in the fact that it's a personnel issue as well. So it's an issue for their newsroom in terms of their credibility, but for Nina Totenberg and the person who is her immediate supervisor, it's a personnel issue that maybe we won't know right away what happened, if anything, because there is that level of privacy that we as used to manage newsrooms know that there is some need for discretion when it comes to personnel.
Yeah, it was a tough one. I asked myself the question, what would happen to someone with less experience, with less stature, whether it was her, whether it was the reporter or the editor or producer who let it go through without questioning it, that they both are culpable. And I don't have a black and white answer for that question. I imagine in your own newsrooms, if you have somebody of her stature that screws up, even screws up royally, you don't want to lose that person. You're going to still, this was a horrible mistake. You have to live with the embarrassment. And I don't, you could ding them somehow, but I don't,
yeah.
I don't know. There's a more levels of people would not all be treated equally for this transgression.
Yeah. And this is not an isolated incident. It just within the past week, the same sort of thing happened with Mitch McConnell, who is not dead to our knowledge. But The Hill, which is based on Capitol Hill, as the name suggests, published digitally an article that was clearly intended to be embargoed, not to be used until it did. It was headlined "A Look Back at Mitch McConnell's Time in the Senate." And there was an all caps thing at the top of it that said, "Do not use." Notwithstanding, it was published. So here is another issue where something actually that's a quality control, right?
We talk about the news media making mistakes. Every day we make a lot of mistakes. We don't do it on purpose, but some of them are bigger than others. And this was a big one. Just so people know, almost every major newsroom has obits or look backs or retrospectives of major people, especially major people who are older, ready to go. How do you think that the New York Times publishes these great obits within an hour of someone dying? It's ready to go, but there are protections in place.
You don't want it to go until they go.
Yes.
Yeah, and in the Hill's case, the protections were not there. Somebody made a mistake. Mistakes happen. We have to forgive them. You have to understand the consequences of the mistake too. How serious was this? How is it a blip? Is it something that can be recovered?
That's a great point for both of those instances. We do more hand-wringing about it in the media than most of the public is doing. Happened and they fixed it and they took it off and it's over and done with.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true. But the bigger question is the responsibility of journalists who cover Capitol Hill to get to Mitch McConnell to try to find out what's going on there, because he's a crucial vote. A lot might be lost that the administration wants to do, or who knows, since McConnell has been so independent lately, maybe not. But reporters have been trying to get to him. And here's an example, by the way, of the value between reporting versus online popular sources. Laura Loomer, the right-wing activist who has a great many millions of followers online, claimed without evidence that McConnell is, quote, brain dead and in a, quote, vegetative state and will not be returning to Congress. But there is no evidence to support that. And that, of course, would not be published by any reputable news organization. If you are following online influencers, folks, or have people whom you really like to pay attention to, be sure that they have legitimate sources for the information they present. Laura Loomer is not a credible source of information.
I heard a discussion of this on cable TV in which it was focused on how closely aligned Laura Loomer is to the White House, and the implication there being that she does have inside information. What's happened with the Mitch McConnell story? In the absence of good, solid reporting and good, solid information, speculation's gone crazy. And all sorts of bad information is out there. And we're looking for proof of life. Scott Jennings, the CNN commentator who used to be a Republican operative. He has come forth and said he's talked to him. He seems fine. What obligation does the senator have to his constituents? All sorts of issues are raised, but again, you have to balance it with the guy's right to privacy. If he's lying in a hospital bed trying to get better, how much information does he have to tell the public?
Media at WAMC.org is how you get to us. The other big story that has drawn attention for Reporters Access is reporters who uncovered Donald Trump's role in the World Cup reversal by FIFA. The decision that of the U.S. soccer star, the decision to bar the U.S. soccer star Falarian Balogun from playing in the big World Cup game, which was turned back, of course, and then Trump claimed credit for it. But the word first came out. There was really top-notch reporting from The Athletic, which is the sports site that is now owned by the New York Times, from the Wall Street Journal, revealing that this decision to allow the American star to play against Belgium, in fact, was made after Donald Trump intervened.
I thought that was great reporting, and I'm so glad that not glad that it happened, but I'm glad that it got reported. That's a really great example of where good reporting and spreading the word makes a difference. That really cast a shadow over the U.S.'s role in the whole event. It was very telling about FIFA, as if you didn't already have opinions about FIFA. So I gave them a round of applause for revealing that.
And the good thing about the story, it was easily confirmed because the president posted something on his own social media network confirming it, making the story that much easy for reporters to follow up on. Easy story. Thanks a lot.
It's an amazing thing. But having the capacity to get the sources inside FIFA who will confirm, yes, the head of FIFA had a conversation with the president, and that somehow there is not a direct statement until the president said, yeah, I talked to them and I made it happen. But that is why reporters spend time developing source networks. It's why it's worthwhile for it to have beat reporters as opposed to somebody who can just swoop in and do a single story. Because sometimes it is developing relationships over a long period of time with the people that you cover day after day that yields the inside information so that you can use it for
and,
that
and recognizing that it is a story. That was an international story. Everyone was talking about it.
Absolutely.
And still will be,
absolutely, long after this World Cup is over, and it taints the entire presentation of the World Cup. It, as one of the headlines of one of the commentators' sites said, Donald Trump has ruined the World Cup. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but it certainly did take the wind out of the sails of a really great event, didn't it?
It's an embarrassment for the country, but without wandering too far into the editorial zone of it, it just demonstrates why it was important to report. And you're right that it takes sources to get it and then the reporters to recognize this is a big story.
In New Jersey, there is New Brunswick Today, a digital news operation that had a school surveillance video of a lockdown. There was a lockdown at New Brunswick High School in New Jersey. Parents were told it was only a drill. But New Brunswick Today got footage showing security officials surrounding a 16-year-old student and confiscating what appeared to be a gun. They published this, and immediately there was action by the school board attacking New Brunswick Today, and eventually a judge of the New Jersey Superior Court, a guy named Thomas McCloskey, issued a temporary order for the video's removal, barred New Brunswick Today, which is often only the only outlet covering central New Jersey, from writing about that episode or publishing other unrelated school security footage that it might have. It seems to me, a pretty clear case of prior restraint, which is unconstitutional, isn't it? I just can't quite understand how this happened.
Has New Jersey withdrawn from the United States? It's like totally prior restraint. Totally. The story floored me that this would happen in our country.
I had to read it twice to even understand what they did. They took away the video. Why? The kid had a BB gun, which qualifies under firearms, which are not, you're not allowed to be carrying a firearm into the school. Was there any case made for not showing that video because the kid was a minor?
It could be that
and
there would be.
Is there some justification for protecting the identity of the kid?
You could make a great argument that it was ethically improper for them not to fight out the face of the kid to show.
But that can be done.
Right. Yeah. That's the only part I took issue with.
This is an issue of public concern, and this is a judge doing what a judge should not have done. I hope they fight this. I hope they succeed, because if this starts to happen, the newspaper most likely would have done something to protect the identity of a youthful offender or the child involved. But wow.
Well, the district exacerbated their situation by lying, by saying that this was just a drill. And then now they have no credibility.
So just so that we understand the standard here, the Pentagon Papers case more than 50 years ago established the near prohibition against prior restraint. And so this, though, shows the of judges in this era who are willing to step forward because of the loss of support, I'm afraid, for First Amendment freedoms among citizens of the country. We're out of time on that sort of glum note, folks. That's all we have time for this week's Media Project. Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us. David Gustina is the producer of the Media Project, and we hope you'll come back again next week and join us for the Media Project.
But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people, when they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, Newspaper Guild.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, and Raga Justin, Albany bureau chief for Bloomberg Government. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
No worries for publishers must go. To working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.